Welcome to this special audio supplement to a satellite CME symposium held during the 2018 ASCO annual meeting in Chicago. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with two of the faculty members who participated in this symposium after the meeting, Drs. Axel Grothy and Philip Philip, to discuss their perspectives on the clinical management scenarios presented to the audience and discussed by the faculty, along with questions submitted by the audience members during the meeting. To begin, I chatted with Dr. Grothy, who along with Dr. Scott Kopetz discussed management of metastatic colorectal cancer during the symposium, and Dr. Grothy commented on this question posed to the audience. In recent years, have you observed more patients with colorectal cancer under age 50 coming into your practice? More than two-thirds of the audience said yes, as did Dr. Grothy.
So we have seen actually recent data from the cancer statistics publication that the incidence and mortality of patients over 50 is actually decreasing in colorectal cancer, potentially due to using screening methods, colonoscopies and others, and really detecting polyps and cancers in an early stage. Now, we do not implement screening technologies and screening recommendations yet, and it's just changing actually right now for patients under the age of 50. And so in contrast to the over 50-year-old population, we see an increase, an absolute and relative increase of cases, incidence of mortality in colorectal cancer under the age of 50. Now, I do see that in my clinical practice, but at Mayo Clinic, of course, it's kind of a referral bias. I mean, we see younger patients, and I think the same is true for Scott, for instance, Scott Kopetz at MD Anderson. That is a select patient population, but the overall data statistics that just came out earlier this year clearly indicate there's an increased risk of colorectal cancer for the younger patient population. Still a minority, of course, of all cases in colorectal cancer. The majority of cases is beyond 60 years of age. But I think we have to keep in mind that the lifetime implication of an early diagnosis cancer is potentially stronger than someone who is 85 years old and gets diagnosed with a cancer, because you have more life to lose. And patients who are in the 40s or in their late 30s, they at the very moment they have young families, they are in the work life, the implications for these patients is huge.
What about the pathology or pathophysiology of what's going on? Why is it that we are seeing this incidence? I was doing a symposium recently with your colleagues, Tony Saab and John Marshall, and they were joking around about eat dirt, you know, tell your kids to eat dirt or put their whatever. So obviously, you know, a lot of people are talking about the microbiome. What are your thoughts about what's going on and why we're seeing these cases?
So since we haven't changed genetically, you know, over the, you know, in the last years, something has to do with lifestyle or the kind of host-environment interaction. And I do believe that the microbiome, which is affected by what we eat, how we live, is contributing at least to the higher incidence of these cancers in early age. There's a lot of environmental and nutrition factors that we can count on. And if Tony and John say, you know, eat dirt, you know, get a normal flora into your gut, that might actually be true. I don't think we fully understand the implication of widespread use of antibiotics, for instance, in farming, how this affects, you know, how our microbiome, our bacteria in our gut get changed, and how this then influences early onset of colorectal cancer and neoplasia.
So let's go through some of the other questions we asked. We talked a lot, of course, about the management of metastatic disease. And one question we asked the audience was, what do they order in terms of biomarkers, in terms of workup? So in addition to RAS profile, we also asked about HER2, BRAF, and MSI status. What do you consider right now sort of the baseline for any patient with metastatic disease?
Exactly the factors that you said, you know, expanded RAS panel, BRAF, and I would actually look at a next-gen sequencing BRAF analysis, because we now need to distinguish between BRAF V600E and non-V600E mutant tumors. I do believe HER2 is part of the panel because it's a negative predictive marker for EGF receptor antibody therapy, that these data are emerging. And it's a target for interventions in various clinical trials. And then, of course, MSI or mismatch repair deficiency to get patient funneled into immunotherapy.
You said HER2 predicts resistance to EGFR antibodies?
Yeah, so that's an interesting point. When you look at the patients who are HER2 amplified, HER2 overexpressed, those patients are commonly resistant to EGF receptor antibody therapy. Let me give you another example. If you look at the overall incidence of HER2 amplification in colorectal cancer, it's about 2 to 2.5%. Now, if you refine this patient population, you say it's a left-sided tumor, RAS, RAF, wild type, and has not responded to EGF receptor antibody therapy, you go up to about 20%. And there are preclinical and more clinical data now that HER2 amplification is one of the resistance mechanisms to EGF receptor antibody therapy, even in left-sided tumors.
That's interesting. Is there any thought about using anti-HER agents in combination with EGFR antibodies?
I haven't seen any data yet, but it could be interesting to explore that.
As long as you mention HER2, and we'll get into the other issues too, but what are the therapeutic implications? Are you using anti-HER therapy in these patients?
Yes, I mean, we have clinical trials at Mayo Clinic and Sarah Cannon that really target HER2 amplification. And it's really following the guidance of breast cancer. I mean, there are data from an Italian study, trastuzumab by Patinib, a combination that was tested in the ALTO trial in breast cancer, for instance, high response rate in the range of about 30%, even in heavily pretreated patients. And more importantly, some of the responses are actually long-lasting. And there's the MyPathway study, which looks at combination of trastuzumab, pertuzumab. Herbert's, you know, published or presented some of the data. Again, similar response rate, 35 to 40% longer lasting. And, you know, this is without chemotherapy. This is just exploiting biology. You use two HER2 targeted agents in a later line setting, and you see durable responses in about 30 to 35% of patients.
So what specifically is a regimen that you have used or would use outside a trial setting?
Yeah, I have used both. I've used trastuzumab, lapatinib, and I've used trastuzumab, pertuzumab. It's very difficult to compare these two right now in terms of anecdotal evidence, which is better. We have evidence and we have safety data for both regimens from the breast cancer world. I mean, these are tolerable regimens. I think right now the breast cancer world and what we're doing in colorectal cancer is more moving toward trastuzumab, pertuzumab. There's an ongoing SWOG study, which is also a registration study in second-line therapy, which actually uses trastuzumab, pertuzumab compared to irinotecan and cetuximab in second-line in HER2-amplified patients.
You know, it's funny because the one thing I didn't hear you say is the most common way it's used in breast cancer, which is chemo plus anti-HER therapy, trastuzumab.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I mean, the SWOG study, for instance, initially had irinotecan as part of the second-line treatment, but I think we want to test biology at first and really get the confounding factor of chemotherapy out of the equation.
So here's a first-line question we asked the audience and got a whole variety of answers, which is a younger patient with a left-sided, microsatellite stable, pan-RAS wild-type, BRAF V600E mutation positive tumor. And the audience, a lot of them would use FOLFOX Bev. Some would use FOLFOX EGFR antibody. Fair number of people use FOLFOXIRI Bev, which is what you and Scott Kopetz picked.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about how you factor in BRAF status as well as sidedness?
Okay, so sidedness, of course, tells us something about responsiveness to EGF receptor antibodies and prognosis. We know that left-sided tumors do better than right-sided tumors. And right-sided tumors, even if they are RAS and BRAF wild type, they still do not respond well to EGF receptor antibody, so that the NCCN guidelines actually do not want these patients to be treated right-sided tumors with EGF receptor antibodies, at least not in first-line therapy. Now, in this case here, a BRAF V600E mutant tumor that trumps everything. This makes this cancer very aggressive. And it's actually probably the most aggressive molecular parameter that we have for these patients. So these patients need special attention. That's about 8 to 10% of patients in stage 4. And we have data to suggest that a triplet chemotherapy combination with bevacizumab might actually be the best way to deal with these patients. Aggressive tumors need aggressive therapy. Now, this comes from sub-analysis of trials, you know, like the Italian TRIBE study, et cetera. So there has never been a dedicated BRAF V600E mutant triplet plus bevacizumab trial. So we kind of look at subgroup analysis. But I think there are three different separate subgroup analysis from trials, and they all suggest that, again, with a triplet combination, you can potentially counteract the negative biology of these BRAF V600E mutant tumors. And that has made inroads into NCCN, ESMO, and Japanese guidelines. Now, the question that we have, of course, is with data like Scott's trial, the SWOG study 1406, where you use the BRAF inhibitor plus an EGF receptor inhibitor plus an chemotherapy like irinotecan, or the interesting results of the Beacon study, which looked at MEK inhibition, BRAF inhibition, EGF receptor inhibition, so all biology, can those, let's say, biologic approaches be better than chemotherapy in first line, like FOLFOXIRI, bevacizumab? We don't know that yet. This trial is in planning, but we don't know that yet.
And actually, we did ask the audience whether they use targeted therapy in patients with BRAF mutant disease, and the vast majority do, and I think the most common answer was exactly what you were just talking about, the regimen of irinotecan with EGFR antibody vemurafenib. Can you talk about your clinical experience, both with efficacy, but particularly toxicity? You got some pretty dermatologic toxic issues here.
And that's the issue. I mean, you combine an EGF receptor inhibitor with a BRAF inhibitor, especially vemurafenib generates photosensitivity, which is one of the first generation BRAF inhibitors, which has fallen out of grace in the melanoma world, you know, so we're not using vemurafenib a lot anymore. So it gave vemurafenib a second life. It's probably not the best BRAF inhibitor there is. What I have more experience with is the combination, which was mentioned, the Beacon study, which is the EGF receptor inhibitor, cetuximab, then the BRAF inhibitor encorafenib, and binimetinib is a MEK inhibitor, which really tries to interfere with the biology of BRAF V600E mutant tumors. Now, the interesting thing is when you combine a MEK inhibitor and an EGF receptor inhibitor, you actually see decreased skin rash. You know, so the skin toxicity actually goes down because some of the skin rash was actually mediated by a paradox, a redundant pathway activation after EGF receptor blockade, and which can be then mitigated by a MEK inhibitor.
That's interesting. You mentioned the encorafenib and binimetinib, and I think I remember hearing that that maybe is a little better tolerated.
Yes, it is better tolerated. I mean, you still have the MEK inhibitory side effects, which is the retinal dysfunction. There's some kind of blurry vision for some time. There's also a MEK potential cardiotoxicity. But overall, binimetinib and encorafenib have shown to be very well tolerated. And it's one of the new regimens in melanoma, which then made it into the colorectal cancer world.
So another issue that we got into that you've been very involved with is later line therapy, and particularly the issue of regorafenib and TAS 102. And interesting, I guess you and Tony Saab presented these data in January. You started 80 milligrams. Can you talk about why you do that and the data that you presented earlier this year?
Yeah, so we had early data, of course, Mayo Clinic being the largest participant in the CORRECT study, you know, which led to the approval of regorafenib. What struck me in my patients, it was a blinded study, but it was easy to see who received regorafenib and who received placebo, because patients really within the first 2 weeks developed serious side effects, in particular hand-foot skin reaction, you know, the inflammatory reaction mainly affecting patients' feet with blisters and inability to walk, then profound fatigue, dysphonia. So patients really noticed their treatment. And what struck me, particularly with the skin reaction, was it is different than capecitabine. Capecitabine is something, you know, hand-foot syndrome, where we know, okay, the longer we treat, you know, the symptoms come over time, and it's not as severe. There's not this inflammatory response. Now, with regorafenib, the skin reaction, this hand-foot skin reaction comes very early on and really covers the first 2 weeks. And I was worried about, you know, patients starting with a full dose and then telling physicians, I can't tolerate this treatment within the first week, and then never having a chance to really see whether the drug works. Because if you only treat patients for a week, you'll never see whether this agent works. So in order to keep patients on the treatment, I thought it would be more important to start with a lower dose, really get, you know, cover the first 1 or 2 weeks, start with half the dose, 80 milligrams instead of 120 per day, and then see how patients tolerate the dose with dose escalation week by week by week. And very importantly, really contact patients, really review with them toxicities on a weekly basis. This is something we did not do in the initial CREX study. Patients came back after 2 weeks. We left them alone for 2 weeks, and they came back with significant side effects, which really kind of led to, you know, a lot of toxicities that I personally saw in my patients. So the strategy of using 80 milligrams per day for the first week, then 120 milligrams, then 160 milligrams, came out of the observation early toxicities, and we need to touch base with the patient at least on a weekly basis to really talk about what's the optimal dose.
So another question we asked relates to the issue of sequencing of TAS-102 and regorafenib. How do you approach that decision, and do most of your patients end up getting both?
Yeah, so I do believe the pool of patients that is candidate for TAS-102 is larger than for regorafenib. I would not treat a patient with a reduced performance status, PS2, with regorafenib, but I would see no problems treating these patients with TAS-102. Now, in a good performance status patient, PS0 and 1, my goal is to really expose these patients to all active agents. And so you have TAS and rego, you know, both there. And my concern is always if you start with TAS early on, which might be more tolerable for patients, they don't perceive, you know, the side effects as much as with regorafenib. But if tumors progress and patients deteriorate in their performance status while they're on TAS, they might not be candidates for regorafenib. So in a good performance status patient, I would talk to the patient, talk about side effects, make sure that they understand that regorafenib is not a cytotoxic agent, you know, not a chemotherapy agent, and that we use regorafenib first, followed by TAS-102, to really enhance the chance that they can be exposed to both active agents.
Let's talk a little bit about checkpoint inhibitors in colorectal cancer, mainly related to MSI-high disease. And one of the questions we asked the audience was, if you put aside regulatory and reimbursement issues, ideally, if you have a patient who's not symptomatic or minimally symptomatic, and has MSI-high disease with metastatic disease, what line therapy would you use a PD-1 antibody? And actually, most of the audience said they would like to use it first line, and seems like you agreed. Do you ever do that?
Yeah, I have done that in a couple of patients, you know, where the insurance companies were actually willing to pay for that. Because it's not FDA approved this way. This would be off-label, and it's not even NCCN guidelines approved. I mean, in NCCN guidelines, we would look at second or third line treatment for patients with MSI-high mismatch repair deficient cancer. But you know, I've seen excellent responses in using pembrolizumab, for instance, a single agent in first-line therapy, durable, complete responses. So all this having said, you know, there are trials that are ongoing or have completed accrual. There's the Keynote study 177, which compared pembrolizumab to standard of care chemotherapy in first line. And there is an intergroup study which looks at the addition of atezolizumab to standard chemotherapy or single agent atezolizumab as a PD-L1 antibody in first line treatment. So at some point we will know whether it's really better to use these agents in first-line treatment or in later lines of therapy.
Where are we today in terms of the data on the use of checkpoint inhibitors, and including the more recent data looking at ipi-nivo? But globally, where are we, first of all, with monotherapy in terms of numbers and response rate?
So when we look at pembrolizumab, nivolumab, the initial data that we saw a higher response rate for pembrolizumab compared to nivolumab. You know, pembro in the range of 50-60%, nivolumab in the range of 30%. But these were very small studies, very small studies. At ASCO recently, when you look at the more expanded experience on pembrolizumab, responses have come down to the 30-35% range. But this is response. There are a lot of patients who also have stable disease. So we're looking at progression-free survival, and there is actually plateau in these patients with single-agent therapy, which could be in the range of about 25-30%. But if we add ipilimumab, you know, to nivolumab, we lift this plateau up by about 15-20%, which is really interesting. So I do believe at some point down the line, we'll move away from just single-agent PD-1 antibodies to combination and potentially even include chemotherapy, which I find intriguing based on the lung cancer data, you know, which really showed immunotherapy, antigen release, priming the immune system, and then taking the brakes off the immune system could actually be the right way to go.
Well, people want to get that checkpoint inhibitor in early anyhow because of the possibility of prolonged response.
Yes. And it could be different in MSI-high colon cancer, which is very immunogenic, compared to kind of lung cancer. It could be different from tumor to tumor. Our problem right now is the MSS tumors. You know, Johanna's trial, you know, the cobimetinib atezolizumab study really did not pay out. And compared to regorafenib, absolutely no different, not even a hint of a subgroup that could benefit.
What do you see in terms of PD-L1 and tumor mutation burden assays in MSI?
You know, it's a good question. I mean, we know that these cancers have very high mutational burden, and we just actually saw data presented that the different enzymes that are deficient, whether it's MLH1, MSH6, or PMS2, for instance, they are associated with differences in tumor mutational burden. So MSH6, for instance, mutation or deficiency have the highest tumor mutational burden, MLH1 lower tumor mutational burden. Now, we have not yet correlated this with outcome.
So you see a high tumor mutation burden in general with MSI-high disease?
Yes, yes. Very high tumor mutational burden.
That makes sense. But what about PD-1 levels?
They are loosely correlated, but when you do multivariate adjustment, PD-L1 in MSI-high tumors do not play a role anymore.
So as you mentioned, you do have these single-arm data sets that look exciting about Ipi-Nivo. Would you attempt to do that outside a trial setting? Could you imagine a situation where you might want to do that?
Yes, I could. I mean, the data, so far we have at Mayo Clinic particularly used a lot of pembrolizumab, but I see the nivolumab, ipilimumab data are pretty convincing, and they are recently published, so you have full publication to go back to. And I believe, you know, this is likely the future. If it was me, myself, I could see getting treated with ipilimumab and nivolumab, particularly since ipi, because everyone's afraid of ipilimumab toxicities, it's only 4 doses at a low dose. So the toxicity is not as threatening as we might have thought initially.
Where are things heading right now in terms of MSI-high disease, and who should be tested for MSI?
I think every patient with a solid malignancy should be tested for mismatch repair deficiency. I mean, that's along the lines of the FDA approval. I mean, the FDA put some thinking to that, allowing pembrolizumab to be used for all patients, not even characterize which kind of cancers, but all patients with tumors harboring this specific phenotype. And so we have an FDA-approved agent that's looking for patients, and we can only identify these patients if we run the test. And if you look at immunohistochemistry, that's a pretty cheap and easy test to use for all solid tumors. So at Mayo, again, we have implemented at least all GI cancers should be checked, and we've left it up to the different disease groups to see whether, for instance, bladder cancer and others, or prostate cancer should be checked too. If I had a cancer, I would like to see what my mismatch repair deficiency status of my cancer was, because, you know, the implication for treatment, even if it's only 1 out of 200, would be tremendous.
So we got a couple questions from the audience about something I wasn't sure why they were asking, which is the issue of, quote, patient with MSI-high disease is also BRAF positive. Do we know anything about that specific subset, and particularly how they respond to checkpoint inhibitors?
Yeah. So about 20%, 15-20% of patients with BRAF mutation are also MSI high. And the biology is, you know, BRAF mutation leads to methylation, higher methylation of DNA, which can methylate the promoter region, particularly of MLH1, the MLH1 gene, which deactivates the gene. So what you have is a BRAF V600 mutation. You see lack of expression of MLH1 immunohistochemistry. And this is based to a kind of a methylation shutdown of the promoter region of this gene. So there is this overlap, but we have seen data in particular from Mike Overman's study that patients with BRAF mutant tumors and non-BRAF mutant tumors, Lynch syndrome and non-Lynch syndrome patients, they respond to immunotherapy in exactly the same way. So whether it's BRAF V600 mutant or not, the MSI high situation or mismatch repair deficient situation is really the most deciding phenotype for the use of immunotherapy.
So one final question about colorectal cancer. We spoke about the issue of cancer stemness inhibitor, napobucosin in particular, that's being studied both in colorectal and in gastric cancer. Can you talk about what we know and what this strategy is based on and what kind of clinical research data we have? Again, Johanna Bendel looked at FOLFIRI plus BEV with napobucosin. Where are we right now with this strategy?
So outside of immunotherapy, I think stemness inhibitors would be the most attractive treatment approaches if we embrace the idea that the tumor is comprised of stem cells and dedicated, more committed cells, which are more susceptible to chemotherapy, whereas stem cells are not very susceptible to chemotherapy, then it's really worthwhile embracing stem cell inhibitor research. Napobucosine, or BBI-608, the old name, is a STAT3 inhibitor, which interferes with Wnt signaling, one of the primordial pathways that can drive stem cells. So there is a lot of enthusiasm to finally have something that, at least in vitro models and animal models, inhibits tumors and tumor stem cells. But now we are trying to move this into humans. Now, the data that we have in humans are kind of a mixed bag of information. First of all, we had a Canadian study which looked at napobucosine in a later line setting compared to placebo. A lot of patients had side effects because the dose of the napobucosine was high, and patients had a lot of diarrhea, did not really stay on the drug long enough to really see any effect. So the initial data of this phase 3 study in later line setting was negative. Now, there was a subgroup of patients with phospho-STAT expression levels, you know, the target expression levels, where there was a signal in terms of improvement in overall survival. Now, in gastric cancer, there was a registration study which looked at adding napobucosine to paclitaxel compared to paclitaxel, and the study was negative. So we have negative data in terms of gastric cancer, second-line therapy, overall survival. Now, we have Johanna's data, or actually data that are generated in multi-institution setting, where the combination of FOLFIRI with or without bevacizumab plus napobucosine actually generated quite interesting stable diseases responses, even in patients who had been pretreated with FOLFIRI with or without bevacizumab. So could it be that napobucosine kind of resensitizes tumors to chemotherapy or exploits a different mechanism of action? I don't know. The data are intriguing enough that we are actually running a phase 3 study in a second-line setting, the CANSTEM C303 study, international study, napobucosine added to FOLFIRI with or without bevacizumab. The study has accrued more than half its population, a target population of more than 1,000. So that's one of those old randomized phase 3 study designs, and hopefully we'll see data probably in a year and a half to see really whether napobucosine has effectiveness in colorectal cancer.
So let's move on now and talk about gastric cancer, which was discussed in the symposium by Charlie Fuchs and Yelena Janjigian. And one of the issues we were getting into there was sequencing of agents in metastatic disease, particularly second and third line therapy. And now that we have checkpoint inhibitors as an option, we asked people in general what their second-line therapy was in HER2-negative gastric cancer after first-line FOLFOX. Most people are saying ramucirumab paclitaxel, but about a quarter of the audience would test for PD-L1 and consider pembrolizumab. How do you sort through that decision, Axel?
Yeah, it's an interesting point, and you rightfully said, you know, second, third line therapy is a wide open field, and I don't think we have this one standard of care. I think first line is pretty much locked into fluoroprim plus platinum, and then there's kind of the Wild West. You have randomized data for paclitaxel ramucirumab, which is probably the most established standard of care. And then checkpoint inhibitors come somewhere in there, and the nivolumab and pembrolizumab, the way they're being developed is a little bit different. Nivolumab tries to develop PD-L1 levels agnostic. They don't care about PD-L1, whereas for pembrolizumab studies, they check their reactive score, their PD-L1 score in immune cells and tumor cells, and only select those patients who are PD-L1 positive. Now, one interesting point was the KEYNOTE-61 study, which compared pembrolizumab to paclitaxel in second-line therapy. I mean, a lot of the studies we've seen in GI malignancies, whether it's HCC, whether it's gastric cancer or colorectal cancer, data that we've seen have been based on single-arm pembrolizumab, nivolumab, plus minus ipilimumab studies, but we didn't have a lot of randomized comparison. There's ATTRACTION-2, which compared nivolumab to best supportive care, so no active control arm. Now, KEYNOTE-61 was the first study in a GI malignant tumor which read out and compared pembrolizumab in PD-L1 positive tumors to paclitaxel, which is might not even be the standard of care, because as the audience said, paclitaxel plus ramucirumab was standard of care. And the study was negative. Negative for its primary endpoint, particular overall survival. But when you looked at the curve, there was an interesting crossing of the curves. There was a subgroup of patients that might have had long-term benefit from pembrolizumab over paclitaxel. And that's the intriguing part. By all hazard ratio and p-value definition, pembrolizumab did not beat paclitaxel, but there was a subgroup of patients that had long-term benefit. And I think our challenge right now is to identify these patients who have this long-term benefit.
It always strikes me as kind of weird when I see these big phase three trials comparing checkpoint inhibitors to chemotherapy. You see it in lung cancer and a bunch of other diseases. And I guess that's just an outgrowth of, you know, how drugs get approved and looked at. But it seems like maybe what you want to look at more is what the chance is of somebody being, you know, free of progression in 18 months or 2 years.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think what we need to change is our readout for regulatory approval. If I see, for instance, a drug that can keep patients free of progression for, let's say, 2 years in about 20-25%, which is the tail of the curve, that is an active agent. We don't see that with chemotherapy. And I believe in looking at the tail of the curve and trying to develop strategies to raise the tail, which could even translate into cure. You know, I mean, if we have a tumor that doesn't progress after 2 to 3 years, that might be good. Something interesting that came up that Scott and I, you know, in our symposium with you talked about is we have both used pembrolizumab in a neoadjuvant fashion and had resected tissue after treatment, which still looked viable on scans, but was actually fibrosis. So sometimes what we see on the kind of residual cancer manifestation on long-term treated patients, you know, on scans, might actually not be cancer anymore, might be just fibrotic tissue.
So there was a question from the audience. Do patients do worse who get antibiotics and checkpoint inhibitors? And i.e., is there a correlation between the gut microflora and the response to checkpoint inhibitors?
So I don't know that, but there were very intriguing data actually coming from, including Charlie Fuchs' group, where they looked at something very cool, that bacteria that colonize the cancer, the primary tumor, can also be found in the metastasis from these cancers, Fusobacterium nucleatum. So, and there were preclinical data and kind of animal data where they actually looked at antibiotic treatment of animals that had the PDXs, the transplanted tumors, that harbored these bacteria. And these bacteria and the cancer responded to antibiotic therapy. So it could actually be a question of which antibiotic do we use for which bacterium. And I can envision that in the future, we might not just check the tumor genome, but also the bacterial genome that is embedded in the cancer.
That's fascinating. Someone said in the question about the combination of checkpoint inhibitors and chemotherapy. Is that being looked at in gastric cancer?
Yes, it is being looked at in gastric cancer. We don't have data yet.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, yes.
Also, in terms of other new things, we saw some data on TAS-102 in gastric cancer. What do we know about that?
Yeah, so TAS-102 actually had a phase 3 study, which was reported out to be positive. And I think we'll see data probably at ESMO this year. It's a phase 3 study in a later line setting. And, you know, it makes sense. I mean, TAS-102 is a fluoropyrimidine. It is not cross-resistant to 5-FU, which is one of the mainstays of gastric cancer therapy in combination with platinum agents or irinotecan, et cetera. So it does make sense that TAS-102 has some activity in a later line setting when you compare it to a placebo.
Interesting. How about regorafenib? There were some phase 2 data looking at that in gastric cancer.
Yeah, regorafenib also has activity based on phase 2 data, the INTEGRATE study, an Australian gastrointestinal tumor study group study, Australia plus Korea. They have very impressive data in terms of progression-free survival, and it's again being tested in a phase 3 study right now against best supportive care / placebo. you know, it gets crowded in this field. Now, when you look at, you have chemotherapy, standard chemotherapy that works, paclitaxel, irinotecan, ramucirumab, in addition to paclitaxel, you have checkpoint inhibitors, pembrolizumab, nivolumab, TAS-102, a cytotoxic agent, and regorafenib likely showing activity in a phase 3 study, the Integrate 2 study. It's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out in terms of sequencing in the end.
So another agent that we talked about that's in development that looks pretty interesting is andacaliximib, a monoclonal antibody. Can you explain what that is and what we know about it?
That's the MMP9 inhibitor, which is kind of a revival of these matrix metalloproteinase inhibitors, because they were on vogue when I did my preclinical studies about 20 years ago, interfering with tumor host interaction. And there are some interesting data, which I would like to see confirmed in larger randomized studies. I'm a little bit skeptical because MMP9 inhibitors have been tried in various malignancies and in gastric cancer, colorectal cancer, pancreas cancer, and actually in breast cancer and lung cancer, and none of these studies was positive. Why would this antibody all of a sudden be positive? Or is it just a fluke? You know, because if you run 20 trials, one of them might actually have a p-value below 0.05.
I next met with Dr. Philip, who along with Dr. Andrew Koh discussed management of pancreatic cancer, and Dr. Philip also commented on new developments in management of hepatocellular cancer, as discussed in the symposium by Drs. Katie Kelly and Andrew Zhu. To begin, Dr. Philip discussed perhaps the most important new GI cancer data set presented at ASCO, the Phase 3 PRODIGE 24 trial comparing adjuvant modified FOLFIRINOX to gemcitabine in patients with resected pancreatic cancer. About two-thirds of the audience said they use capecitabine combined with gemcitabine as their standard adjuvant treatment, but as discussed by Dr. Philip, because of these new data, that is likely to change.
At ASCO this year, we had the results of the French trial, which was looking into FOLFIRINOX versus gemcitabine in patients who have resected pancreatic cancer. There were several important points about this trial, which is important for our day-to-day practice in terms of how we choose the patients and which patients may go into such a treatment, FOLFIRINOX. I have to start, Neil, with saying that the FOLFIRINOX dose they used is a modified dose. When I mean modified, it's really modified because the bolus 5-FU did not show up, but also after treating a number of patients, they realized that they had to reduce the dose of the irinotecan from 180 to 150 milligram per meter squared. And in 60% of their patients, they still needed to use growth factors, GCSF-based growth factors. So it's a treatment that still has a significant degree of side effects. However, they were able to show that with this treatment, they have prolonged the median survival to beyond 50 months. This was really remarkable. If you remember, there was one other study a few years ago with the S1, the Japanese did, and that showed a remarkable improvement in survival. This one really surpassed that. So a significant improvement in the median survival to beyond 50 months. The primary endpoint of this trial, however, was disease-free survival, which was almost doubled by the use of FOLFIRINOX versus gemcitabine alone. The median for gemcitabine was just over 1 year, which is what we have seen in prior studies. But in this trial, it was doubled to close to 2 years. So certainly a positive trial that will impact our day-to-day practice. However, reading in between the lines, you understand that this is a heavy-going treatment, and this is a highly selected population of patients. These patients had to have no history of diarrhea or significant diarrhea after surgery. Their performance status should have been 0 or 1. Day 21, CA19-9 should have been 180 or less. So it was a selected population of patients. And the same argument that we have with advanced disease, patients who go on FOLFIRINOX should be really patients with favorable disease condition, overall condition, including the performance status. It's also noteworthy that when they set a mark of dose intensity of 0.7, in fact, it was a 50-50 chance that patients will be able to do that. So a significant number of patients either required dose reduction, dose delay, or even early discontinuation of the treatment. In fact, the patients who stopped the treatment early due to toxicity or other related issues were 20% or less. But certainly, it was different than the gemcitabine arm, which was better tolerated as we would expect. So based on the results of this trial, in my own practice, in patients who have undergone resection of a pancreatic tumor, including R1 resection, R0 or R1, whether they have lymph nodes or low lymph nodes. They're recovering well from the surgery, and I have a window of 12 weeks as per the protocol. I will consider giving them the modified FOLFIRINOX the way it was given in the clinical trial, and I would also consider adding a growth factor to the regimen. And again, just to remind you that the treatment was given for 12 cycles, so it's a six-month treatment. Again, something else in this trial, they did not include radiation therapy, so there was only a chemotherapy treatment for 12 cycles. That was a planned treatment.
And just to emphasize the actual data, the hazard ratio for disease-free survival was 0.58, 42% relative risk reduction, and the hazard ratio for survival was 0.64, 36% reduction. But what about the fact that the control arm was gemcitabine? Since the trial was started, gemcitabine plus capecitabine seems like it's become sort of the standard. Any way to indirectly compare how much benefit FOLFIRINOX would have compared to gem-cape?
So if I look back at the gemcitabine, capecitabine versus gemcitabine, I personally, I'm not seeing here a major benefit from using the capecitabine over the gemcitabine. And if someone who has a good performance status, I'll be switching to the FOLFIRINOX rather than gemcitabine, capecitabine. One of the interesting things is that even in patients who had the gemcitabine, the survival of the gemcitabine arm was also longer than what we have seen with prior gemcitabine-only treatments. And we think that now we're seeing the effect of subsequent therapies in patients who undergo one line of treatment, in this case gemcitabine, and when they have a relapse or progression, there is opportunity for other lines of treatment. So overall, we're pushing the survival of patients who have resectable disease.
That's interesting. You mentioned radiation therapy. In what situations, if any, do you utilize that in the post-op situation?
So a couple of points about radiation therapy. We're still waiting for the results of the RTOG trial, but that will be a bit of a wait because we still have maybe a couple of years before we have the results. But in the meantime, in my practice at least, I will use radiation therapy in patients who have bulky nodal involvement, pathological, that is, after the surgery. In patients who have R1 resection, I would use radiotherapy, but I will not be using radiotherapy in all patients. The other thing about radiotherapy is that I will combine radiotherapy with capecitabine. And in my practice, I will give the radiotherapy and the capecitabine like we're doing in the RTOG trial, finishing all the chemotherapy and then giving the radiation treatment. Doing it that way will make sure that there's no interruption in the systemic therapy that's now becoming more important. But also at the same time, if the patient experiences any disease progression or relapse outside of the pancreas area or pancreatic bed, then obviously radiation will not be necessary. And the way we do it is obviously we restage them. The French trial did the restaging every 3 months, and I think that's reasonable to do a halfway restaging after 3 months of starting treatment and then at the end of the treatment. And if you're thinking of giving radiotherapy, then you have to make sure that your patient is free from any distant metastases.
What about gem-nab in the adjuvant setting? Where are we in terms of trials on that question? And if a patient asks you about it, would you consider giving it off protocol?
So the clinical trial, which is looking into gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel, is called the APAC trial, which included more than 800 patients. It was completed accrual, the primary endpoint being disease-free survival. The results of that trial are not out there, maybe end of this year, maybe next year. But in the meantime, at this juncture, I am not using gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel off protocol. Maybe I've used it in a couple of patients or three patients with varying circumstances, but it's not a routine consideration for me. I personally think that it's not a combination that is likely to be negative because of the nature of the drugs, but still we have to wait for the phase 3 trial. So the bottom line is that, yes, it's a potential combination to use, but it shouldn't be considered as a routine combination to think of in this disease when we have other potential options. And at this time, we have to wait for the result of the phase 3 trial.
So let's talk a little bit about neoadjuvant therapy, particularly in patients with borderline resectability. What about choice of neoadjuvant regimen? A lot of people will turn to FOLFIRINOX or modified FOLFIRINOX. You were talking in the symposium about using gem-nab in the neoadjuvant situation. How do you decide?
So the reason why we mentioned FOLFIRINOX, because the pilot studies and the one national pilot trial that was done in borderline resectable disease that was recently published It's a FOLFIRINOX-based trial. So there has been experience with FOLFIRINOX at the nationwide level, and people have felt some degree of comfort with it. Surgeons are more familiar with it than the gemcitabine-nab-paclitaxel. Remember, gemcitabine-nab-paclitaxel came at a later date as a regimen in metastatic disease. The issue here is that what people think would be a regimen that produces a more regression of the tumor or a better objective response rate, if you look at the perception, it is that FOLFIRINOX produces maybe more of the objective response rate, and this is what you're trying to do, part of what you're trying to do in the neoadjuvant setting. For that reason, people have been more in favor of using the FOLFIRINOX regimen. However, if you look at the metastatic disease, the differences in response rate, yes, it may favor FOLFIRINOX, but it's not a huge difference. However, the whole issue of the choice of the neoadjuvant treatment will be hopefully settled by the SWOG trial that I referred to earlier, which is looking at the FOLFIRINOX versus gemcitabine-nab-paclitaxel. Here, again, we're trying to look into not only the regression of the tumor, but how much does it really impact on surgery, surgical complications, and ultimately, what is the disease-free survival? Is it really, even if you have more shrinkage maybe with one regimen, but overall, is it going to be impacting the outcome of the patient? And here you have to link it also, again, with toxicity, quality of life, surgical complications, etc. So this is where the field is. At this point in time, I agree that FOLFIRINOX probably is the more favored one. The other issue with neoadjuvant treatment is whether you use radiation or not. We don't use radiation in our neoadjuvant treatment for patients who have resectable disease, but we include radiation in patients who have borderline resectable disease. And again, that's also a research question because the current intergroup trial is looking whether we need radiation in that situation. The reasoning behind using radiation therapy is the fact that in borderline resectable patients, because of the way I describe the anatomy and because the way the surgeon does the resection, especially in the posterior margin of the resection, there is more chance for leaving an R1 resection. And the use of radiotherapy is used not so much to shrink the tumor down. In fact, it's unlikely to shrink the tumor down. It's mostly to sterilize the margins prior to doing the surgery so that you end up with an R0 resection.
So let's talk a little bit about second-line therapy. We asked as a poll question to the audience what they usually use second line after gem-nab-paclitaxel, and the most common answer was NALIRI 5-FU leucovorin. How do you think through second line therapy in those patients, and what about the patients who get FOLFIRINOX first line?
So the majority of the patients still get a gemcitabine-based therapy in the front line, and a fair number of those patients, as you know nowadays, or an increasing number, will be getting gemcitabine-nab-paclitaxel. This is all based on the performance status, comorbidities in the front line, which really means that most patients cannot get the FOLFIRINOX. So when you're done with the gemcitabine-nab-paclitaxel, when you go to second-line treatment, there are several considerations. Number one, neuropathy. So if the patient has neuropathy from the gem-nab-paclitaxel, then obviously you can't go back and use a platinum like oxaliplatin in the second line. But really the most important consideration here is what is the evidence out there? What sort of evidence do we have for second line therapy after a gemcitabine-based treatment? For a while, we were using a lot of oxaliplatin-based treatment, FOLFOX or OFF, which is the European regimen. However, especially with FOLFOX, which is the regimen preferred in the United States, after a while, we had results which were conflicting results based on one trial which may have favored the oxaliplatin-based use in a different way. But then the Canadian trial came, and it showed that, in fact, FOLFOX in the second line was not better. In fact, it was worse than the control arm, which was 5-FU alone. So based on that, and based on the fact that neuropathy is a factor in choosing the second line, and also based on the information from the NALIRI trial, which is NALIRI 5-FU versus 5-FU alone, which is a phase 3 trial, randomized phase 3 trial that was positive, met its primary endpoint, which provides a level 1 evidence. At this time, I think more people have, including myself, we've been using the NALIRI plus 5-FU as a second line treatment. In fact, if you use it second line, you still have the option of using oxaliplatin-based treatment in the third line. So it becomes more like a doublet in series. If you would, like you have gemcitabine-nab-paclitaxel front line, you go to the NALIRI 5-FU in the second line, and then if the patient can make it to the third line, you can come back with an oxaliplatin plus 5-FU, hoping that even if they had neuropathy, that neuropathy had improved by then. But most patients, unfortunately, do not get into third line.
Could you talk a little bit about your experience with NALIRI 5-FU in terms of tolerability and efficacy?
So in terms of the tolerability of the treatment, we more or less are able to get patients through the treatment, but then again, we do the following things. In most patients, I would still start with the full dose that's recommended, which is 70 milligrams per meter squared of the NALIRI. However, I also start with lower dose, like 50 milligrams per meter squared, in patients who I feel that they need the dose reduction. For example, patients who've had a lot of problems in the front line, patients who've had radiation treatment as part of their treatment prior to getting the NALIRI, patients who are older. So I really use judgment here. So I don't start everyone with the 70 milligrams per meter squared. I also do the UGT1A1, which can give me an indication of how to reduce the dose of the iron tincan in patients who have the Gilbert syndrome. Now, the side effects that we see with this treatment are what we expect with a regimen which includes iron tincan and 5-FU, although in some ways I have been seeing less side effects than I would expect, and it's partly because the way I have been dealing with their side effects, being more proactive in terms of the diarrhea, I don't really see much in the way of neutropenic complications. If anything, it's going to be the diarrhea and also the nausea, the vomiting, hair loss, and we've been managing them relatively well. In terms of efficacy, as you recall, the NAPOLI 1 phase 3 trial showed that the combination doubled the progression-free survival and also improved the overall survival. The median overall survival was improved by approximately 2 months, maybe just under 2 months. So overall, it's a regimen that has been well-tolerated, and there have been updates on its efficacy, and again, confirming that it's an active regimen in the second line. Certainly, I see more of disease stabilization than I see big reductions in the size of the tumor, but I've had patients who've been on it for a good number of months. Again, we try to be very careful in the dose reductions when necessary and closely monitoring the toxicity of the regimen, seeing the patients maybe more frequently to start off with, especially the older patients who go on it.
One of the people in the audience asked the question, could you compare NALIRI 5-FU leucovorin to FOLFIRI?
So no one has really done a study to do a head-to-head comparison. The idea of the NALIRI or the non-liposomal iron tincan is that the way the pharmacokinetics and the pharmacodynamics of the drug go is that it's retained in the tumor longer, the tumor environment. And it's a long discussion about this. However, what it really means is that the exposure of the tumor is more efficient exposure of the tumor to the drug, to the active drug, and also the active metabolite. Having said that, I mean, you can see the proof because you're using a lower dose of the drug than the iron tincan and the FOLFIRI. The side effects are probably, the quality of the side effects will be similar, but the intensity of the side effects, from my experience, we're seeing less side effects than the FOLFIRI. Now, in terms of efficacy, I'm not sure if it's going to be much different or any different, although at least based on the experimental evidence, it's a better drug than the straightforward iron tincan. And there will not be any study to compare them head-to-head, but at this point in time, based on what we have known about the use of FOLFIRI and iron tincan in this disease, there is evidence based on that NALIRI works better than the iron tincan. Again, there might be other studies in the future that we will have with FOLFIRI. It may shed more light about the differences between the two, but biochemically speaking, biologically speaking, it is a better drug when it comes to tumor exposure to the active cytotoxic moiety.
I'll ask you a few questions about new directions in the treatment of pancreatic cancer, and one that we actually asked the audience about, we said, should patients with metastatic pancreatic cancer be tested for BRCA, germline, and or somatic mutations?
So in my practice, I routinely do genomic profiling on the patients with stage 4 pancreatic cancer who are embarking on treatment. And one of the reasons is the BRCA. In fact, that's a major reason. BRCA mutations, germline, and also some somatic, when you add to that, can make up to 8-9% of the patients. But also the percentage varies in which location you are in the United States for other reasons. The other thing you can find from the genomic profiling would be the MSI high, which will be 1-2% of the patients only. So patients have BRCA mutations. At this point in time, I do not start with a PARP inhibitor right away. In fact, I do start with a platinum compound. So platinum compound you can make an argument for FOLFIRINOX, or you can also discuss the use of cisplatin itself. And I have experience with both. And the data so far have indicated that if you use a platinum compound, you have a very good, and not only good as in prolonged, but also a deep response to chemotherapy with the use of a platinum compound. And Eileen O'Reilly published her work using gemcitabine and cisplatin. Now, I do not use the PARP inhibitor up front. The way I use the PARP inhibitor, and I have a patient now who's been on it for many months, is when they get the induction chemotherapy, let's say with the gemcitabine cisplatin, they have a very good response. And then after a while, in the patient I have, the most recent one, after actually 4 months of treatment, because he was a physician and wanted to go back to work, I switched him to olaparib, which is one of the PARP inhibitors. Again, at this point in time, I don't have a choice of one drug. It depends on which drug I can put my hands on, and the patient is being maintained on it. As we speak, there are trials looking at both, looking at the value of adding a PARP inhibitor to the chemotherapy from day one. Also, there's an international trial called POLO trial, which is looking at induction chemotherapy with a platinum compound, and then once the patient is stable disease or better, then they can be maintained on a PARP inhibitor. Of course, we don't know how long we have to maintain them. At this point in time, we don't, but in my patient, I'm going to maintain the patient for as long as the patient has no evidence of disease progression.
So one other new approach I'd like to hear your thoughts on, and that's the idea of stem cell inhibitors and the first-in-class agent napobucosin. I asked Axel about this, but I also wanted your take. What do we know about stem cell inhibitors in pancreatic cancer? Tony Saab had a presentation at the ESMO World GI Congress looking at napobucosin with nab-paclitaxel and gemcitabine. Can you talk a little bit about the idea behind this treatment strategy and what we know about it?
So pancreatic stem cells or cancer stem cells in general have been always a target that we wanted to go after, but the issue is developing the right drug to do that. And there have been attempts to use other agents. So far, we haven't been successful. Napobucosin is a newer drug that targets the signaling pathway, which is a STAT3. And the signaling pathway, STAT3, is not only in stem cells, but the one in stem cells is critical in terms of arresting their growth and even causing apoptosis. And there is ample preclinical work to support the development of this class of agents. And napobucosin has been tested in combination with gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel. That was a study that was completed, and you're right, it was presented by Dr. Saab. I was there when he did that last year in Barcelona. And that trial showed a significant improvement in the progression-free survival, which is really the basis of interest to develop the drug further. The combination was relatively well-tolerated, maybe some additional fatigue and GI side effects, but otherwise it was a reasonably well-tolerated combination. At this point in time, we have a large randomized phase 3 trial, which includes more than 1,100 patients, and currently it's underway. So we hopefully, within the next couple of years, will know more about this drug and how it really will be helping our patients. So if we can block the stem cells, the idea here is that we will be able, with chemotherapy, to clear as much as we can from the tumor cells, and then the stem cells, which are the problem in terms of regeneration, if we try to really get rid of them, we may be able to get the patients into a remission for a longer time.
So let's talk a little bit about hepatocellular carcinoma. And we asked a pretty straightforward question of the audience, which is, what's their usual first-line therapy, assuming the patient has good hepatic function? And while the vast majority of the audience still says sorafenib, there were a number of people, including one investigator, who said they'd like to, and this was regulatory issues aside, start out with a checkpoint inhibitor. What's your usual first-line therapy for HCC? And if you could use a checkpoint inhibitor first-line, would you do it?
So my first-line use of treatment is still sorafenib. At this point in time, I am not really convinced myself that I would like to jump into a checkpoint inhibitor as a front-line, unless I have some more data in terms of its benefit relative to sorafenib. And I'm saying this not only meaning sorafenib, but also there's another drug, which is lenvatinib. As you know, it showed activity in this disease in a non-inferiority trial versus sorafenib. It also had a longer progression-free survival and probably was better tolerated than sorafenib. So I'm not sure at this time I would replace either of these two drugs with a checkpoint inhibitor for frontline treatment. That is something open for discussion, and I'm not as yet convinced that it has to be a checkpoint inhibitor frontline.
That actually is my next question, because that was an answer given by a number of the audience. Len Batnib, can you talk a little bit more about what we know about that agent compared to sorafenib? And if you could use both, how do you decide between them?
So it's also a multi-kinase targeting agent. It does appear to be having less in terms of toxicity than sorafenib. And as I mentioned in the non-inferiority trial, large trial, it showed that in terms of survival, it's not any worse than sorafenib, but the progression-free survival was improved. And my reading of the tolerance is also, it looks to be better. So there's a possibility that if it's available, it will start to replace some use of the sorafenib. I would like to use more of it if I have the ability to do so, because my experience with sorafenib has been, and again, the patients we treat with HCC with sorafenib are not exactly the patients we treat or were treated in the SHARP trial, for example, because we treat patients who are a bit beyond the conditions of that trial. Again, it will be interesting to see whether lenvatinib will fit better those patients who are borderline performance status, borderline Child-Pugh classification.
So let's talk a little bit about second-line therapy. Can you review what some of the options are that you consider? Obviously, we have regorafenib now that's a consideration. Maybe you can talk a little bit about the data we have there, as well as checkpoint inhibitors.
So the second-line space is becoming crowded. And again, we have regorafenib, which was tested against a placebo in patients who failed the sorafenib, and there was a benefit in terms of the progression-free survival and also overall survival. So that became sort of a standard treatment. But at the same time, we have the checkpoint inhibitors, as you mentioned. So these will be other options that we have that we can use in the second-line setting. The third option would be cabozantinib, which you know was also positive in a phase 3 trial. So that would be also an availability, but it's not approved at FDA yet. The fourth one would be ramucirumab, which is the drug we use in colorectal cancer and also in patients with advanced gastric cancer. And that drug is a VEGFR2 monoclonal antibody given every 2 weeks, so it has some sort of convenience. And that drug also has been shown in the recent presentation in ASCO that in patients who have HCC and an AFP level of over 400, those patients benefited from ramucirumab and is relatively well tolerated. So in a short period of time, we will have probably four options in the second line therapy: regorafenib, immune checkpoint inhibitor, we will have also the cabozantinib possibly, and also ramucirumab. Certainly the ramucirumab and the cabozantinib are not FDA approved at this point in time, but they may be. So it will be an interesting way of trying to choose which one to use in different patients.
Can you talk a little bit about dosing if you are going to use regorafenib? Obviously, there's been a lot of development in that area when it's been used in the colorectal cancer setting. They use full dose, but these were people who were coming off sorafenib and presumably tolerating it well. If you have a patient who's coming off sorafenib and they were able to tolerate it, what kind of dose do you use for regorafenib?
In my practice, with the type of patients I treat, I do not exceed 120 milligrams as a starting dose. And I'm aware of the data Dr. Saab presented, starting with the lower dose in patients with colorectal cancer and building up the dose. I do 120 milligrams, but there will be patients who I will do 80 in HCC because of, again, their overall health condition and built up the dose. I personally still struggle with the full dose of the regorafenib, whether it's in colorectal cancer or in HCC.
You mentioned cabozantinib. Can you talk a little bit about your, I don't know if you have any experience with the drug and how it's tolerated?
I haven't used it, but based on the data presented by Dr. Abu Alfa, it appears to be relatively well tolerated, but I haven't used it myself.
Can you talk a little bit about the data we have right now on checkpoint inhibitors in HCC?
As you remember, the study that was done a while back with the nivolumab, and it was a pilot trial, and it had multiple arms. And in that trial, there was evidence that nivolumab has activity in a proportion of patients. Again, we're not talking about a large number of patients, but probably in the region of 15 to 20%. And this was accompanied by, in patients who had response, it was a durable response. The patient's response was maintained for a good number of months and even longer. And it was relatively well tolerated. The other thing is that in that trial, they didn't see much difference in the response based on the etiology of the HCC. And as you know, that got approval by the FDA. And so that's how we have an option in the second line. There's also evidence that pembrolizumab has activity in this disease, as I would expect, being similar molecules and targeting a similar target within the immune system. So that's another option for the patients, is the pembrolizumab.
And have you yourself observed any useful responses to checkpoint inhibitors with HCC?
Yeah, I mean, currently I have a patient who is getting pembrolizumab, and he's been on it for, I would say, close to 2 years. And he's getting, as part of the clinical trial that he started approximately 18 months or 2 years ago. And again, it's a response that has been maintained for quite a long time. So to me, it's impressive. But the issue is, how do we know which patients are going to have such a response? And for that reason, if I knew that better, I probably would have used it in the front line in patients. But I don't have that knowledge. This patient got it as a second line after failure of sorafenib. And I'm just giving you at least one recent experience I had, because I saw the patient recently in the clinic.
So another question from the audience relates to systemic therapy of patients with advanced liver disease, poor liver function. How do you use TKIs? How do you use systemic therapy in HCC in the patient who has compromised liver function from cirrhosis?
So the use of the TKIs in patients who have Child's Pugh classification, like B, especially beyond B7, really we don't have literature evidence of any safety data, because people haven't done studies specifically looking in those patients. So if I have to treat a patient, it will be the use of a lower dose of the drug, as I indicated earlier. If it's a sorafenib or a regorafenib, I will start with a lower dose. I will start with half dose, maybe. But my experience has been, in patients who have poor liver function, and you're giving them TKIs, they really don't do well, whatever you do. So you are treating two diseases. One is the cancer, one is the cirrhosis. And if the cirrhosis is that bad, patients really aren't going to do well on these doses of, even the lower doses of the TKIs. Sometimes when the patients have poor liver function and there is a lot of symptoms, I have seen colleagues who have used FOLFOX, believe it or not. FOLFOX is a regimen that we use in metastatic colorectal cancer who have liver metastases and abnormal liver function test. And FOLFOX appears to be, I wouldn't say well-tolerated just like that, but it's simply different than giving a TKI. So that's something which one may consider giving chemotherapy. Now, FOLFOX is rarely used, very infrequently used in this country, but there is evidence for its use in China and other places. So that would be one option in someone who you're afraid, or we are afraid of giving either sorafenib or regorafenib, especially with regorafenib, which can affect the liver function further.
So another question from the audience relates to your use of local therapy in the liver, including TACE. What specific types of approaches do you like to see used in your patients, and when do you use them?
So the hepatic artery-directed therapies, and there are at least three of them. So you have the bland embolization, you have TACE, and you have the radioembolization. No one has done a head-to-head comparison to see which one is better or which one is better tolerated. But in my experience, radioembolization is my preferred option, also because I can use it if you have vessel obstruction. It's probably the preferred way of doing it rather than using TACE when I say vessel portal vein obstruction or occlusion. So radioembolization does appear to be preferred in that situation. The liver-directed therapy, again, sometimes can be overused, and I've seen patients who have very advanced disease and you do liver-directed therapy. The risk with it is also that you can push the patient into liver failure. That doesn't happen often, but it can happen if you have someone who's really very advanced and also with poor performance status. The studies that have been done looking at survival benefit with liver-directed therapy, there are not really that many studies done looking specifically at the question whether it really helps the patients in terms of survival. But again, the information that is out there in the literature really indicate that the people who are going to benefit from it are the ones who have relatively good liver function and relatively good performance status. So it comes down to, in someone with HCC who has really poor liver function and poor performance status, I'm not sure if we have any treatment at this point in time which I can recommend that is going to make a big difference to the patient. And it makes sense, because if you have someone whose liver is too bad, you know, and whatever you do carries the risk of changing the balance into a rapid deterioration of the whole patient.
So you mentioned ramucirumab and HCC. Can you talk a little bit more about what we know about that and also what we learned in the past in terms of bevacizumab?
So one of the things which may be a bit surprising is that bevacizumab didn't show as much of a benefit. We didn't see really a good, strong signal there, which really killed the further development of bevacizumab in that setting. Whereas sorafenib, for example, which is VEGFR2 inhibitor, had benefit. Moving forward with ramucirumab is a VEGFR2 receptor monoclonal antibody blocker. And the trial that was done in all comers, as you remember, although it showed some improvement in progression-free survival, the primary endpoint, the survival, wasn't really helped. But then a sub-analysis found that AFP400 was a group who benefited from it. And they went back and did the phase 3 trial that Andrew Zhu presented in ASCO. And here you see a benefit from the ramucirumab. But even then, the benefit is not like a spectacular benefit. It really improves survival by approximately 2 months. So there is improvement, but it's not really a huge benefit. So overall, the anti-VEGF treatments, including the tyrosine kinase inhibitors that target VEGFR2, have some modest benefit. It's not a huge benefit, but it's enough to be a treatment option to be offered to patients. The ramucirumab is interesting. The question is, how do we compare it to other second-line options, although it has a niche only in the patients who have over 400 of AFP.
Yeah, that was really interesting. I guess I was just presented the REACH2 study that Dr. Zhu presented at ASCO. So just thinking about these two diseases, pancreatic cancer first, any approaches that you're particularly excited about in either one of these cancers in terms of new research directions?
So for the pancreatic cancer, the BRCA is only the beginning of what we call going after DNA repair defects. DNA repair defects have been shown in the major genomic studies to be responsible for maybe 10 to 12, 13, 14% of the patients. And understanding those defects beyond just BRCA1 and 2 will result in better treatments in that segment of patients. So that's something which will expand, but we're limited somehow by biomarkers that we can use to identify those patients. And that's the research that has to really be more developed. And it's underway. A link to that, we're also trying in pancreatic cancer to develop subclassifications which are more functional, more clinically relevant, and that will be underway. In terms of targets in pancreatic cancer, philosophically, we have now moved into a different phase of target therapies. Whereas in the past, we were thinking of one molecule, EGFR, IGF-1R, VEGF-1, VEGF-2, VEGF-3, or things like that. Now we're moving more into the functional aspects of the disease, which makes more sense because the functional aspect has more linkage or correlation with the clinical outcome. So the example we used today, we talked about the targeting BRCA1, BRCA2, DNA repair. It's all based on some clinical correlates that we're working on. EGFR didn't have any clinical correlate. The other thing which is really exciting in pancreatic cancer is looking at the microenvironment, because the area or the neighborhood of the pancreatic cancer cells is really very important in terms of cells, immune cells, myeloid cells, etc., but also the matrix, the proteins, and the other material there. So one approach which is currently of interest to see what will happen in the phase 3 trial is the use of the pegylated PEG-PH20. It's a hyaluronidase recombinant human, which is pegylated. You can give it IV, add it to chemotherapy. And the idea is that when you break the stromal barrier hyaluronan, you might be able to deliver treatment better, get a better outcome. This has been shown in the preclinical models, moved into a pilot phase 2 trial, again showing some promise, and now moved into a phase 3 trial in selected patients for the hyaluronan expression. So that's a trial which I think you have to keep an eye on, and that will take maybe another year or so to get the results or something like that, or 18 months. So that's another area which is of interest. There's one other drug, which is the IL-10, the IL-10 agonist, and that showed some interesting activity in patients with pancreatic cancer when combined with chemotherapy in the second line. And that has gone also into a bigger randomized trial. So that's an area which is of interest, because there you're trying to stimulate or improve the function of the CD8 cells that are really getting into the T cells to try to kill the cancer cells. Another area of interest would be the combinations of drugs for immunotherapy, but at this point in time, really, we're too early in that, and we don't have any good signals. But people are trying hard to combine things together. They're combining checkpoint inhibitors with vaccines, with radiotherapy, with other drugs. CSF1R, for example, combined with nivolumab was discussed in a meeting and shown that it has some activity in a small number of patients. So there are combinations where people are looking at when they're combining the immunotherapy with other drugs that can modulate the microenvironment and let the checkpoint inhibitor or other drugs to work better.
This concludes our program, and we should note that subsequent to recording this discussion, the combination of nivolumab and ipilimumab was approved for the treatment of patients 12 years of age and older with microsatellite instability high or mismatch repair deficient metastatic colorectal cancer that's progressed following treatment with a fluoropyrimidine, oxaliplatin, and irinotecan. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special audio supplement to a satellite CME symposium on GI cancers held during the recent 2018 ASCO meeting.